Welcome to episode 83 of Junk Filter. My name is Jesse Hawken, and my returning guest is Ethan Vestby. He's a writer whose work has appeared in film stage, and he's a huge fan of our subject for today. Ethan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Jesse. And yes, it's a pleasure to talk one of my all-time favorite actors, Mark Wahlberg.
Our subject for today is the new Mark Wahlberg film, Father Stu. Co-starring Mel Gibson, directed by Mel Gibson's girlfriend, Rosalind Ross. This is a special Good Friday, Easter Sunday treat from the notoriously Catholic movie star.
Yeah, he's kind of the Easter Bunny this year. It is basically the Passion of the Christ.
It even features the director of The Passion of the Christ, Mel Gibson, playing Mark Wahlberg's father for the second time in their career.
After Daddy's Home 2 from 2017.
Did you see Daddy's Home Part 2?
No, I wanted to initially. I think I couldn't convince anyone to see it with me, and it was one of those movies I don't really want to go see by myself, or else you'll have a bit of a what am I doing with my life moment. But I did this past holiday season. I'd always seen it on Netflix. And as I sat down, I said, okay, I was like a lazy, like December 22nd or something. It's like, I'm going to watch Daddy's Home 2 to get in the Christmas spirit. I sit down, fire up Netflix. It's not on there. I think it had been shunted off to everyone's favorite streaming service, Paramount Plus. So, I mean, no Daddy's Home 2 for me still, but maybe this coming holiday season I'll shell out $5 to rent it on Google Play or something.
A lot of people enjoyed Daddy's Home. It had some goodwill, but then all the people that love these hilarious comedies that Mark Wahlberg makes were very upset by the provocative casting of Mel Gibson. Mel and Mark are two of Hollywood's biggest right-wing Catholics.
I mean, I guess like with Wahlberg, he's sort of like, what's the term? You played under your vest?
Keeping it close to your vest?
Keeping it close to your vest. That's what I'm thinking of. I think he's always been a bit that way with his politics. I know he endorsed Hillary in 2016, but I mean, the kind of the impression I got from that is that his wife is really good at busting his balls. basically based off some of Mark's statements in the past, maybe about 9/11, and also some of the films he's chosen to be in, you could at the very least say he's right wing adjacent.
Wahlberg has been trying to make this movie for a few years now. It's based on the true story of a man named Stuart Long, who was an amateur boxer who became a Catholic priest, whose life was tragically cut short from a very rare muscle disorder, a muscle disintegration disease, very similar to Lou Gehrig's disease. He died at the age of 50, and Mark Wahlberg has been trying to tell this guy's life story for a long time. At one point, Wahlberg was even trying to get David O. Russell to direct it. And Wahlberg said that he was inspired by Mel Gibson, who spent something like $30 million of his own money to get The Passion of the Christ made. And here's a quote from Mark Wahlberg. "I slipped the script to a couple of people that I thought maybe would get it, and they didn't." And obviously, it's subjective. You have your own feeling of what the material is. Some people thought it was depressing because he's sick at the end. They didn't see the heart and the emotion and ultimately how inspiring it is. So when they asked Wahlberg how much of his own money he spent on this film, he said, "Let's just say I put millions and millions of dollars into this film." He said, "I cannot take credit for the movie's success because this is God choosing me to make the film. He knows finally I get to utilize all of the talents and gifts that have been bestowed upon me for his greater good and to serve my part in his big picture."
Well, I mean, in regards of him financing the movie, maybe you noticed this if you've watched any of Wall Street, but I believe at the beginning of the movie it said it was a Municipality Pictures yeah. production, and Municipality is like the name of Mark Wahlberg's like golfing visor line. So I guess he's finally gotten into that side of the business.
Let's talk first, before we get into this, about your relationship with Mark Wahlberg. He's a bona fide movie star. We've had him in our lives for at least 25 years now.
I mean, I'm trying to remember what would have been the first thing I saw him in, maybe like The Perfect Storm or something. But I'd always liked him, and he always was in movies that generally, like even from my early cinephile years, that I was interested in seeing or my parents were interested in seeing. But I think there was a bit of a shift, I'd say, around 2008, I want to say, where he became a bit of a joke. Mm-hmm. I believe there was the 1-2 punch of The Happening, his performance in M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening, and also the Andy Samberg Say Hi to Your Mother for Me spoof on Saturday Night Live.
Which apparently he was actually really angry about, I heard.
I can imagine Mark being a thin-skinned man, to be honest. This came a few years after his Academy Award-nominated performance in The Departed, where I think he'd kind of finally cemented himself as a prestigious actor. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's always... an interesting thing about Mark, and this is, I think, something to kind of compare to his career now, is that he definitely was, a prestige actor for a while, where if he was in a movie, it meant Martin Scorsese, Paul Thomas Anderson, James Gray, David O. Russell, Tim Burton. And I don't know if it just his... if some people stopped returning his calls or whatnot, but I'd say maybe his taste has gotten a little worse in recent years. And I think he had a bit of a second wind as a serious actor with David O. Russell's The Fighter, but then kind of came, I'd say, a point where his interest started to shift a little, and he became kind of a joke again based off like his Instagram, which is like mostly him like hawking like energy bars. And I think it's sort of like what makes him so interesting. Beyond, I do genuinely enjoy him as an actor a great deal, is that his career is like this weird process of his stock rising and falling. And I guess you could say this sort of afflicts a lot of the big stars of his generation. I mean, Leo is sort of the only of those Gen X guys that's like been consistently respected and popular. But if you look at like Matt Damon, also another Boston guy, like he's basically at a point where all his movies are flopping. He keeps saying all these tone-deaf things in public. Nobody likes him anymore. Ben Affleck, another Boston guy, all his movies flop. He has at least what he can say is that he's consistently kind of like in the tabloids and famous. And Matthew McConaughey, another of that generation, is also all his movies are bombing. But he's now kind of like turned himself into this self-help guru / likely the future president of the United States. Maybe of those stars, he's the one who's most analogous to Wahlberg.
Mark Wahlberg is kind of like Damon and Affleck in the sense that he's a movie star whose fans are also big fans of sports.
Exactly. we cannot do this episode without mentioning Wahlberg's classic television show Entourage. Partly based off his own life. Kind of one of the interesting things about Entourage is that clearly there was a point where that show's stock was very high in Hollywood, and anyone who is anyone would guest star as themselves on it, be it, Martin Scorsese or Matt Damon. But then there was a point in like the last two seasons where all the guest stars are just actors, or sorry, not actors, just sports stars, mm-hmm. who are all brutal, especially the very worst of all, Mark Cuban, who they like give like his own like little arc throughout the second to last season, where Turtle is trying to finance his tequila company. But yeah, it's and also I guess again, if you look at Mark's Instagram, it's just him hawking like protein shakes and whatnot. He's kind of in the same zone as like other people like The Rock and Ryan Reynolds, these sort of like hyper capitalist movie stars, who like probably spend less time like doing movies than they do hawking products. Mm-hmm. And some of it, honestly, I find a little like beneath Mark. I mean, maybe part of the charm is him embarrassing himself a little, but a part of me is a little sad when I see like a video of him, shirtless, and it's going to be like, yeah, this lemon protein shake. It's the best one. You got my word. You should try it. It seems a little beneath him to me.
I was reading about Mark's Catholic beliefs, which this movie is one of the most explicit movies that he's made yet about his devout Catholicism. He says that he maintains a relationship with a spiritual director who's a priest named Father Flavin. How stereotypically Catholic can you get? This guy knew Mark Wahlberg when he was a high school dropout and has been leading him to the life that he leads today. Wahlberg says that he's been in my life since I was 13. He married me and my wife and baptized all my children. And Wahlberg also says that Father Flavin guides him in his movie choices for the roles that he accepts.
So like Max Payne, he's like...
It's funny, when you read like Catholic website articles about Wahlberg, they talk about what a devout Catholic he is and how he is spiritually driven to play parts. And then they'll have a separate paragraph that says, but he's an actor, so he knows that he has to play all sorts of characters, including characters that he doesn't morally agree with. So that you can't blame Father Flavin for Daddy's Home 2.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you watched this episode of Wall Street, which we should mention is Mark Wahlberg's reality show on HBO, which had its first season last year, which mostly follows Mark as he juggles his business ventures, film career, and family life and religion. There's an episode in the middle of the season where he's doing a Zoom call with someone he wants to make a documentary series on for HBO. And I think this figure is like kind of represents the Wahlberg mindset, where he's a man of the cloth who also runs a hedge fund. And to me, I think to Wahlberg, that is the most inspirational figure, a deeply religious person who's also a hyper-capitalist.
Yeah, I saw a little bit of Wall Street in advance of the show, and I was struck by Mark Wahlberg's spread at his ranch. Like, he lives in what appears to be a castle. With this weird community built around it, I guess, for his, you know, his entourage and his staff. It looks like he's got a big staff that goes with him everywhere.
Yeah, well, yeah. So he definitely has an entourage. And the thing about that show that's really interesting is that you do get a little bit of the impression that Mark is going through a bit of a midlife crisis, where he has everything he wants, but he's not happy. And he seems like kind of permanently miserable. Like, there's a lot of good clips of him behind the scenes of shooting like Antoine Fuqua's Infinite, where clearly, you know, he's like between takes and they pull him aside and he goes into a tent where he has a bunch of like investors talking about, you know, launching a Wahlburgers in London. And he just looks so pissed off listening to them talk. And he's almost like kind of the Charles Foster Kane of Hollywood or something.
We have a Wahlburgers in Toronto. I still haven't gone there. Can you give us a restaurant review of Wahlburgers?
I've been multiple times, I can tell you that. I once managed to drag my girlfriend there, and she'll never, you know, forget to mention that they charged her $4 for a flat Diet Coke. So take that as you will. But I will personally recommend the turkey burger, which on the menu is listed as Donnie's favorite. They say which is favorite. There being, you know, Mark, Donnie, and the third brother, who I think basically did everything for the restaurant, and Mark just took a lot of the credit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know much about the third brother. Donnie Wahlberg has that weird career where he was a teen pop star in New Kids on the Block. Then he became a serious actor. He's in The Sixth Sense, but he's been marooned on television for years on that endless cop show Blue Bloods with Tom Selleck.
Yes.
Which is like Dad's favorite TV show.
Yeah, I should mention a great thing about the Toronto Wahlburgers location. I don't know if it's the case at all the other ones, be they in, you know, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Croatia, wherever. But the walls list like the titles of all of Mark and Donnie's movies. I know someone who knew someone who said when James Gray was in town for his retrospective at TIFF a few years, he asked, what restaurant should I take him to? And I was tempted to say, you should take him to Wahlburgers so that he could see the yards and We Own the Night on the wall of the restaurant. But and also there's the wall for Donnie that just says Blue Bloods pilot in parentheses.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I personally haven't been in a while. Another interesting thing about the restaurant is it clearly wants to be a lot of things, where there's a sit-down area where it clearly wants to be like Applebee's, and there's like kind of another area where it's like a McDonald's fast food restaurant. So it tries to be kind of everything to everyone. They also sell merchandise at the place, and I'm kind of kicking myself that I still haven't bought myself a Wahlburgers hat or a golf tee, but, you know, maybe next weekend.
Is there Catholic stuff in a Wahlburgers? Is there special messages like the way that In-N-Out Burger has biblical verses written on their takeout bags?
No, but there is on the wall a quote from Mark where they quote him on his sold out show at I think it's, which is it, like Massey Hall or whatever. He remarks on his 1992 sold out show in Toronto. He just said, just a quoted list, "I remember that night." And also another quote on the wall that says, "I challenge Ty Domi to a fight."
Yeah.
So you get a lot of, you hear a lot about Toronto's, or Mark's connection to the city of Toronto on the walls of the Toronto location.
Now, Wahlberg has worked with great filmmakers and visionary directors, but I think the most significant partnership he has with a filmmaker is with Peter Berg. The Wahlberg-Berg union has produced 5 movies.
Yes, I'll admit I've not seen their last one, Spencer Confidential. But I've very much enjoyed these films, and maybe an interesting connection they have to Father Stu beyond just the kind of vaguely right-wing politics is that I think Lone Survivor, the first film they made together, is sort of the beginning of like Wahlberg's martyrship, where basically that whole movie is just him like tumbling down a hill and he like hitting his head on rocks. And it's all about, you know, the toughness of the military and whatnot. And what this one guy, real life figure, Marcus Luttrell, you know, as a kind of, you know, a Jesus-like martyr in its own right, kind of.
Yeah, that's based on a true story, as is 2 other films that Berg directed with Wahlberg. Deepwater Horizon, which actually played at the Toronto Film Festival and got good reviews.
It did. And
the other one, Patriot's Day. And in fact, didn't they both come out within like 6 months of one another too?
Yeah, I think they were both like third or fourth quarter 2016. Well, Patriot's Day is about the 2016 Boston Marathon bombing, an event I can still remember being like at a restaurant in Montreal, like kind of like a bar and grill, and watching coverage of it on the TV as like tanks were rolling down the hill of down the streets of Boston, and the city was under lockdown, and be like, holy crap, this is crazy. But in the film, it dramatizes the event, but of course has Wahlberg playing a fictionalized cop who's seeking redemption, and of course represents the best of the Boston spirit. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like presents a diaspora of Boston as the whole city comes together to find Doja Cat and the other one. But the best part of the movie is the absolutely insane end credits. And this is a running theme of the Berg, Wahlberg true story films, is that each of them have this like very extended end credits, which like is like a tribute to the real people the films are based off of, where they show you footage of them. In this case, I think the Patriots Day one is the craziest because it's like, I think like close to like 10 minutes long. And it's just like interviews with the people who were there. Then it like concludes with like footage of like opening day at Fenway Park. It's like the Red Sox are coming out and fist bumping all like the cops and firefighters.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could say it's like kind of, you know, crypto conservative, right wing, Blue Lives Matter, blah, 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 blah. But I think there's something actually kind of, and this is the thing I'll say I like about Berg. There's something just sort of genuine about it. Like, I think he genuinely believes in the American project. And he believes that these things bring out the best of us and bring us together. But it at like 10 minutes, like I watched this movie on Netflix. I cannot imagine sitting through that in a theater and probably like looking at the other people be like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, that one, Patriot's Day, it was almost like deja vu to me because it seems so reminiscent of Deepwater Horizon, which was had literally come out 3 months before Patriot's Day, which is another film based on the true story of the gigantic BP environmental disaster where this oil rig had technical problems that were pushed by some of the higher ups at BP and led to this devastating environmental catastrophe. It's a pretty effective and well done movie. There's a lot of Mark Wahlberg doing what could refer to as bozo acting, copyright Lex G.
Yeah.
That lots of hamming it up in that film. But the big star of that movie, to me, even more showy than Wahlberg in that film, is John Malkovich, who plays one of the BP executives. I want to talk about that with you for a minute or two.
He's outstanding. I can remember seeing that in the theater and being like a little shell-shocked in a good way.
Because Malkovich is supposed to be this Louisiana sort of Cajun guy, and he's really, really hamming it up in that part, like almost like he's inventing a new form of acting.
Yeah, and you posted we were talking about this earlier today over Twitter DMs, and you're posting the clip, and there's this sort of like odd there's this odd contrast between like Malkovich's absolutely ridiculous Cajun accent. Which, you know, because Malkovich, as we all know, already speaks with this odd kind of affected voice. And putting Cajun on top of that just makes it sound like unlike anything I've ever heard before. But you have that, and then you, like, watch his, like, physical performance, which is actually quite good, as he's kind of, like, bored listening to Kurt Russell. And he's, like, just sort of touching his face. And it actually reminds me of, like, real people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, like, it's an interesting performance. And I think, generally, Peter Berg's actually pretty good at casting and good with actors. But, yeah, he clearly let Malkovich go ham there.
We a big company, Mike, BP. Very big, far-reaching, complex organization. A lot of moving parts, millions of moving parts, thousands upon thousands of people. And we all work very hard to ensure that all those people and all those moving parts are functioning properly as a means to an end, a very profitable end for all of us. So they the big picture, they the little picture, like you, and the malfunctioning shitters. But you see, in point of fact, they all kind of interconnected. They flow at work here, Mike. So if you off, it's off. Then I'm off, then we off, then the whole damn train is off. You feel me, Mr. Williams?
And then there's the other incredible Peter Berg, Mark Wahlberg movie we need to talk about called Mile 22, which is actually fictionalized, but seems to take place in realpolitik environment. And it is also, Mile 22 is clearly designed to be the first part of a new Bourne-like series about this incredible CIA operative. But Mile 22 was a huge bomb.
Well, you never know. There could be like a Blade Runner 2049-esque legacy sequel 25 years later.
It's true. Audiences might have thought that they missed the first 21 entries in the Mile series. Yeah. Like maybe the only one they'd seen was 8 Mile.
Well, I mean, the thing about Mile 22 and Peter Berg in general is that I guess you could say his style has always been sort of a second-rate Michael Mann or Paul Greengrass or Tony Scott.
Yeah.
But in this movie, he really amps up the, like, aggressive editing and camera work. And it's – I remember I saw this with my past guest of the show, Will Sloan, and also friend Alan Jones. We just went to see this on a Sunday night, kind of expecting something on par with, like, kind of like a Liam Neeson action vehicle. Just, you know, a movie to go see. And we were – all like kind of like just dumbstruck at what we witnessed, both in terms of the absolutely insanely aggressive Peter Berg style, the absolutely hateful tone of the movie, and on top of it, Mark Wahlberg's extremely aggressive meatball performance. This is the first film we should mention. I mean, I don't know if I've necessarily seen every Mark Wahlberg film, probably close to, but this is, I believe, the only film where he plays an autistic character.
Yes.
And Mark really uses that as an opportunity to flex all his acting muscles.
They didn't teach anything about cesium at MIT?
I didn't go to MIT.
Well, let me give you a little science lesson then. You know what happens when you ionize a protein? You ever read Hiroshima by John Hersey, Pulitzer Prize winning writer, essay on the atom bomb? Because John Hersey wrote about the survivors, all right? He wrote about how he reached out to take the hands of women in the wake of the bombing in Japan, and their skin slipped off, like gloves. And then you know what happens next? Your kidneys fail. Your lungs collapse. You cannot breathe. You cannot think. Your thyroid just evaporates, all right? Then your lymphocyte cell count takes a nosedive.
Jimmy.
We're looking at approximately 60,000 people becoming jello on our watch, all right? That's what this shit does.
He plays a CIA officer and exfiltration expert who is also bipolar. But he has this thing in the movie where he maintains focus by compulsively snapping a rubber band that's on his wrist. He's just constantly stinging himself with it to maintain focus.
I was going to say the opening credits of Mile 22 is pretty insane, where they include a clip from Wahlberg's childhood where that's being explained to him that he has this condition. Then it'll play a clip of like Trump and Kim Jong-il meeting.
The other funny thing about this movie is that Mile 22 is set in this fictional Southeast Asian nation called Indokar, but was filmed in Atlanta and in Bogota. But what I find so strange about this movie is that Malkovich is also in this film as the leader of Wahlberg's extraction team, and they're assisting them via satellite from Bogota, working remotely. And so I was just wondering, why not just set the film in Colombia? Like, why film in Bogota pretending to be an Asian country with Spanish writing everywhere?
Maybe it was like Jamie Foxx and Miami Vice for refusing to shoot scenes in South America or whatever. I remember there's actually a very potent political image that's kind of stuck with me to this day from that movie, where I think their team is setting up and they place an Obama and a Trump bobbleheads right next to each other.
Yes.
Kind of implying that they're, you know, basically the same, you know, when it comes to the aggressive imperialist American model.
Yeah, and Mile 22 is also distinguished because it has incredible mega violence in it, where even I, who can tolerate almost anything, was stunned at how violent it was. One incredible scene where I would have lost it in the movie theater is that Mark Wahlberg puts this guy's head through a car window and then saws it off with the broken glass.
Yeah. He definitely had to speak with his priest after shooting that.
There's one funny moment in one of the episodes of Wall Street that I watched where he's trying to get his team excited about this new film that he's going to be making called Uncharted. And he bitterly mentions that he's the sort of the older male sidekick in this film. Like, you can tell that it bothers him.
Yeah.
He's reached this point in his career now where he's second banana to a new movie star. And worst of all, Tom Holland as that new movie star.
Yeah, I'd be pissed.
But so there are these little glimpses of the bitterness and the midlife crisis that Wahlberg is in. And I think Father Stu, frankly, comes from that impulse.
Yeah, and I think I know season two of Wall Street is happening. So I'm imagining we're going to see the behind the scenes of Father Stu as, Wahlberg goes aside to, invest in crypto or something between takes. Yeah, well, this is sort of just in general the weird thing with Mark, and you kind of see it with Wall Street. The series ends with a cliffhanger of sorts, where he's playing like a game with his youngest son and asks, "Do you think I should just do the business ventures, or do you think I should keep making movies? Which do you think I should do?" And I think Wahlberg is at this sort of interesting point of his career. He's 50. He's going through his midlife crisis where he clearly is insanely wealthy and doesn't need to keep making movies. But I think deep down, it is actually the thing he likes doing the most. Mm-hmm. Yet he has his taste has gotten so bad, and what he picks has gotten so bad that his stock as a movie star just keeps falling. Yet, he's willing to put his money where his mouth is and, like we said, self-finance Father Stu with the Municipality Entertainment.
Hey everyone, I'm Mark Wahlberg. I am so excited to share with you the trailer for my new movie, Father Stu. I found his story to be so inspiring that I knew I had to find a way to bring it to the big screen.
Let's not waste either of our time. I'm a Catholic.
Well, ain't that what confession's for?
You can't date someone who isn't baptized.
I thought you was gonna say Hispanic. Where's the water? I'll do it now.
I know I'm not what you used to, but not what you deserve either.
Life's gonna give you a gut full of reasons to be angry. You only need one to be grateful. Oh,
I'm praying for you, Bill.
Don't you dare. You're violating my rights.
There's a man going around taking names.
We've all been wronged, and we've all done some wrong.
But he came to forgive us.
Everybody won't be treated all the same.
There's no easy way to deliver this news. You have a progressive muscle disorder. The muscles weaken until they cease to function.
Is there anything it doesn't mess with?
Yeah, erectile function.
I'm trying to be a priest, pal.
This film was directed by a woman, a female director. I don't hear too many people, though, saying that we need to go and see Father Stu to support female directors, maybe because of her association with one of the stars of the film, Mel Gibson.
Sadly, yes, her deep association with the star, Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson was canceled a few years ago, but he has this sort of low boil comeback. Like, he's never totally returned to prominence, but, you know, he did make Hacksaw Ridge, which got something like 5 Oscar nominations, including Best Director. And it seemed like Mel was on his way to reclaiming his former glory. But in the last few years, it sort of calcified into sort of freak show cameo roles and things like Daddy's Home 2 and right-wing entertainment, like I would say Father Stew is, and also the great Dragged Across Concrete.
You're right. Mel is sort of interesting because he does sort of self-sabotage himself just constantly whenever he's on the verge of like a flat-out comeback. I mean, if you'll remember I think he was getting back into people's good graces when Apocalypto was about to come out. Then he got, you know, pulled over, shall we say. And then, three or four years later, he was, again, getting back into people's good graces. Leonardo DiCaprio was going to star in a Viking film he was about to direct. Then, let's say, some tapes leaked. And this also happened to overshadow Jodie Foster's The Beaver, which, yes, I believe he received very good reviews for his performance. But again, people weren't really willing to give that movie a chance. And there's also been other things, you know, documented about him. I don't know if you've read Joe Esterhaus's comments.
I sure have.
Trying to collaborate on a film about Judah Maccabee. I mean, beyond all the nuts stuff, my favorite thing from all of that is how Esterhaus said that, like, Gibson was extremely insecure about losing his looks and would just like look in the mirror and scream, "Why the F did God do this to me?"
Yeah, Esterhaz, even in this, he wrote this open letter to Mel Gibson, which I think got published somewhere, where they were working on this film about the Maccabees. And Esterhaz accused Mel Gibson of being a full-on anti-Semite who was trying to get people off his back by making this film and being the most inappropriate person to make this film. So they had this huge falling out. And the other thing was that Winona Ryder came forward a while ago and said that Gibson had said some incredibly anti-Semitic things to her, to her face. He called her an oven dodger, i.e. Jewish. And Seth Rogen said, "Well, that's a start. At least that means that Mel Gibson can admit that the Holocaust happened."
Unlike his father.
Yeah. But Gibson's response to this story that Winona Ryder said was that she's lying, that he never said that.
I mean, I guess in Mel's defense, he was maybe like blackout drunk when it happened.
Yeah.
As he was known to partake of the sauce. Mm-hmm. Back in the day.
But a lot of Hollywood people have come to Gibson's defense. Like, Robert Downey Jr. won a Lifetime Achievement Award and mentioned that in his acceptance speech that people need to give Mel Gibson another chance. And Jodie Foster put her reputation on the line for Mel Gibson, too, even though he's such a legendary homophobe. And there's a little homophobia in Father Stew, by the way.
Yeah, well, I think the most interesting case of someone in Hollywood being willing to forgive him is Danny Glover, who he may collaborate with on Lethal Weapon Finale, which Gibson is supposed to direct. I think it's supposed to be an HBO Max original. Mm-hmm. Personally, I'm very stoked for that movie. I think it might have a bit of Zoller energy. Yeah. But I mean, like, and Danny Glover is like one of the few people in Hollywood with genuinely good politics in terms of, I mean, his social justice credentials, but also like supporting unionization efforts across the country and financing a lot of films by like Apeacha Pong, Weir Sethakul, and Lucretia Martel. Mm-hmm. And I think it's maybe just a generational thing where he's of a like forgive and forget kind of mantra that people don't have today. Mm-hmm. But I think him and Gibson in a movie together in 2023 or whatever, that to me sounds like one of the most interesting things you can probably do in mainstream movies these days.
To talk a little bit more about Gibson's relationship with this movie was directed by Rosalind Ross. She's 31 years old. She's 35 years younger than her boyfriend, Mel Gibson. They have a child together as well. They've been together since 2014. She was tasked by Wahlberg to write the screenplay. this film had been in development for a long time, including working with David O. Russell as a possible film director of this. But Wahlberg was so happy with the results that he chose her to direct the movie. And they had a 30-day window to make the film. Speaking of the David O. Russell connection, I saw some... There were some stretches of Father Stew that felt like David O. Russell could have made this movie, including having Wahlberg being funny in the movie, which is something that Russell always brought out from Marky Mark and things like I Heart Huckabees. And also the appearance of Jackie Weaver, who was in The Silver Linings Playbook.
Yeah,
it had that sort of screwball comedy. When Father Stew is trying to be hilarious, there are these sort of screwball moments in it.
I can definitely see that. I mean, I could also, I wouldn't be entirely surprised if Wahlberg tried to get James Gray to direct this, but as a Jew from Brighton Beach, maybe had some difficulty relating. I don't know.
Yeah. But yeah, so this movie, I was interested in seeing it because it's a first-time filmmaker with not a lot of credentials. But you and I went to see it together last night. What did you think about it in terms of filmmaking?
I mean, I'll say the filmmaking is not very good. I mean, it kind of feels like a TV movie, I won't lie. But, you know... people, it seemed, we saw this also with, like, I'd say there were maybe 20 people there.
Yeah.
I think like an older crowd, like half the crowd had like a hacking cough. So I think that's maybe a sign they were old. But I mean, I heard a lot of laughter and I heard some sniffles. Maybe that was just they had COVID. But but I think, you know, say what you will, maybe the filmmaking isn't the flashiest, but I think it got to the people in the audience. Rosalind Ross, she might have a future.
Yeah, well, she said in an interview that I saw with her that she's got another project with Wahlberg in development. So maybe we'll see. Maybe he's going to work with her instead of Peter Berg for the next few years.
I mean, yeah, I'm sure someone could, you know, point this out on Twitter for a lot of likes and retweets. But Mark Wahlberg, I think, has worked with more female directors in the past. Past 20 years than Leonardo DiCaprio has.
Yeah, good point. So much happens in this movie and that it feels kind of like the movie is a different movie every 10 minutes because it starts off with him being a boxer, sort of a long-in-the-tooth boxer. Like he's a guy in his mid-30s who's still fighting for very small prize winnings and crappy trophies, who decides to become an actor and goes down to Hollywood, where that doesn't work out for him either. Then he meets this woman that he's very horny for, who is a Catholic school teacher. She's a Mexican-American. And he starts courting her by pretending that he's interested in the Catholic Church, even though he comes from a family of atheists who have rejected God from a long time ago when Mark Wahlberg's little brother died as a child. And I guess, you know, so his family didn't really believe in God because how could God let something like that happen? But the funny part is that Mark Wahlberg, in trying to get into this girl's pants by pretending to become Catholic, gets into an accident on a motorcycle and decides that he actually does want to become a priest.
Well, something I thought was actually sort of interesting about this movie is that in a way it feels, taking into consideration Wahlberg's career, it really feels like an inverse Boogie Nights. It feels a bit like Dirk. I was thinking of the scenes of Wahlberg in Hollywood. It felt a bit like Dirk Diggler 25 years later.
Yeah.
But I mean, we have to remember that Wahlberg has sort of denounced Boogie Nights, saying he still asks for forgiveness from God for that movie. So I feel like in a weird way, this movie is a response to that, where it's like someone shunning God, you know, the godless Hollywood to... get in touch with his faith. And there's even a bit of a, you could say, an explicit nod to that in a kind of homophobic scene where someone tries to get Wahlberg on the casting couch.
Yes. And that scene is really sleazy. And it's prefaced by another little question mark moment where Wahlberg is walking into a hotel and a woman is walking out that he gets, they lock eyes as they're passing each other. But then we see that she's a trans woman.
Yes. I think there was a little bit of an anti-woke agenda to this movie.
At one point, Gibson, who plays Father Stu's father, who's an alcoholic and a bitter, you know, working class guy, talks about how all the people in Hollywood are a bunch of fruits and nuts. So there's there's this 5 or 10 minute stretch in the movie that's got, it doesn't go into like over the top homophobia, but there is certainly a lot of gay panic.
Yeah, and I think maybe they're keeping their hypothetical audience in mind for this.
Who do you think the audience for Father Stu is? That's a question that I had while I was watching the movie. What do you think?
I was thinking when you were watching it last night, who are these people here seeing the movie with us? I mean, they were like kind of, I guess you could say they're the kind of people who talk out loud during a movie. During the scene where Wahlberg is getting baptized, the woman behind us said, oh, he's got an excellent body.
That scene was really fucked up. There's a scene where Mark Wahlberg gets baptized as a, you know, guy in his late 30s, early 40s. And he strips down shirtless in the church. And the music over the scene while the water's being poured on his head is You've Never Been This Far Before by Conway Twitty, which is one of the sleaziest country songs. It has nothing to do with a Catholic rite. But there's also a sleazy moment where you can see that the woman that he loves is really turned on by him being shirtless in the church. I don't know what's going on in that scene.
I think there's a little bit of Mark's ego maybe at play there.
And I can feel your body tremble as you wonder what this moment holds in store. Bum, bum, bum. And as I put my arms around you, I can tell you've never been this far before.
In our current landscape of cinema, where everything's sort of filmmaking by committee and trying to appeal to the largest possible audience and making sure that all these benchmarks are hit in terms of marketing and stuff, and now I look fondly on anybody who's trying to make an ego trip movie, like a vanity production. For Mark Wahlberg to get Columbia and Sony Pictures to put out this personal project about a Catholic priest who is also a bit of a bozo, who gets redemption, and he sank his own money into it and wanted to make this movie. But I don't understand who it's for, because it's obviously meant to be faith-based entertainment, and it's supposed to appeal to the God's not dead crowd and the heaven is for real crowd. Except this movie is full of profanity, and it easily earns its R rating. So how are church groups supposed to get the flock to do group outings to see this movie when it's full of, blasphemous language?
I mean, yeah, I guess like back in the day, I remember when The Passion of the Christ was a big deal. It's like church groups were taking like small children to see that movie. But I guess for them, the extreme violence would be far less of an issue than a few bad words. But yeah, that's a good question. But you were talking about this, how you think there's a bit of a MAGA evangelical thing to this movie, right?
Yeah, I mean, what we see now in the United States with the support that evangelicals have for, you know, piggish men like Trump, and the sort of this fake debate that's going on right now about cancel culture and free speech. What I find funny about it is that the religious right now have to sort of look the other way at profane content in movies and entertainment made for the supposed devout. A movie like God's Not Dead or Heaven Is For Real is very easy to sell to religious audiences, but this movie you would think would be disqualified just from the coarse language alone.
Yeah, and I don't know, like I remember seeing an interview with Mark Wahlberg. I think he was doing the press tour for Transformers: Age of Extinction. And he's like, "Yeah, there's some bad language in there. I'm gonna get in some trouble with my wife." So I guess even in Mark Wahlberg's own home, foul language is an issue that comes up.
But I'm sure that it's being embraced in terms of the current sort of thing that's going on in hard right conservative circles, which is that if it's profane, that's an indicator of how authentic it is. And we also find ourselves now in this weird position where the right are more in favor of obscenity than the left are, or the Democrats are.
Yeah, you're right. You're right on that. I mean, I wonder if religious groups would also take an issue with the fact that there was a scene where before Stu's motorcycle accident, he's visited by what it seems to be Jesus.
Yes.
But Jesus telling him it seems to be played by Rob Zombie, which I thought was an odd choice.
Yeah. And just in case we weren't hit over the head by that, after he gets into this motorcycle accident, which is a pretty graphic and out of nowhere moment, because he's drunk driving on a motorcycle, he is visited as he's bleeding on the road by the Virgin Mary.
Yes, it's a very touching scene. But I think it's like kind of like stuff like that is when you say that this movie is unlike anything else playing in wide release. I think it's the stuff like that that sort of exemplifies it. And you're right that this is like a for no one movie, but that makes it more interesting. I actually kind of, the most like almost charitable thing I could say about it is it sort of reminded me of some of John Ford's movies from the 30s and 50s.
Yeah.
Like some of his more modest ones, like Judge Priest or whatnot, or even like some of the biopics he made in the 50s, like The Wings of Eagles, mm-hmm. which has a somewhat of a similar structure in terms of someone becoming disabled. But
you know what else? You know what? Who else it reminded me of was this film seemed like something that Clint Eastwood could have made. In some ways, too.
That did cross my mind. If you just put his name on this, would we be saying, "Oh, this is strong classical filmmaking"? I mean, I think Clint has a few less kind of sweaty close-ups in his movies. I mean, this is sort of interesting to bring up in the terms of this movie being directed by Mel Gibson's girlfriend. Is that she makes him just like look like total shit throughout the movie. I think there's like at least three close-ups or shots that start on Mel Gibson's beer gut.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that was a subject of contention in the Gibson family home, especially knowing Gibson's own insecurity over his faded looks.
Well, yeah, she films her boyfriend, Mel Gibson, like 100 miles of bad road. Like it's really unforgiving footage of his wrinkly face and his overly tanned skin and his, craggly beard. He looks like a madman in a lot of this movie. And he looks every one of his, however old he is, 68 years on the earth. And his girlfriend is like 35 years younger than him and is filming him like a granite wall. And the other thing that is funny is that he has an estranged marriage. He's separated in the movie from his wife, played by Jackie Weaver, who's like half a foot shorter than him. But over the course of the movie, they become a couple again. And in fact, their atheism gets conquered and they become religious at the sight of their son's sacrifice and his son's devout beliefs that puts a lot of characters in this movie to shame. I want to mention one of the other actors in this movie named Cody Fearn, who plays this pious seminary student who doesn't think that Stu has what it takes to really be a priest. And in terms of like Clint Eastwood style cliches, we know that these two characters don't get along. And then when they're assigned their rooms at the seminary, they discover they're roommates. Like that's the kind of bozo moment that the 1517 to Paris would do.
Yeah. I mean, that actor, he looked, I mean, this is kind of this the kind of low rent quality of the movie kind of bleeds off and things like that. But, like, you've got Wahlberg, you've got Gibson, you've got Jackie Weaver, and you have Malcolm McDowell.
Yeah.
Basically, everyone else in the movie, like, looks like a deep fake or something.
Yeah. His friend Ham. He's got a friend named Ham. The other thing that I thought was funny about this movie is that Stu is being really racist in front of his black friend in this movie. There's that scene where they're playing basketball together at the seminary, and Stu says that he thought that he'd be better at basketball because he's black.
Yeah.
That's that sort of right-wing Clint Eastwood sort of that it's okay to be racist as long as you're joking, let Gran Torino pushes a lot. Like, oh, racism is okay. It's just people making fun of each other. If somebody makes fun of your race, make fun of their race. They love it.
Yeah, the barbershop scene in Gran Torino is kind of that mission statement.
But like, Stu is mixed up with this Mexican-American actress played by Teresa Ruiz, who you described as sort of like an Ana de Armas type.
Yeah, I was saying it's like you'd think they would cast an Ana de Armas or something, but they kind of, I mean, I don't know. Okay, I'm trying to find an unmean way to say this, but they kind of cast someone who like doesn't look like she's on a CW show.
Yeah.
which I genuinely liked.
I remember that actress from Narcos Mexico. She played one of the cartel queens. And in this movie, she's this devout Catholic woman who is saving herself for marriage. And this is something that I thought was strange, considering that this film was directed by a woman, is how the female characters in this movie have to put up with the guys being guys in this film. Like, she gives up her virginity for Stu because he's injured and she feels sorry for him, and she does love him and she expects to marry him. So she actually betrays God by giving it up before marriage. And then Stu just meets her at a cafe to tell her that he's going to become a priest, which requires a vow of celibacy. And she's really pissed off at him because he basically like lied to her to get into her pants. But this is coming from a female director. Nothing else is made of it, though. She supports him in the end, and she accepts the fate that, you know, he's got this terminal disease. But like, she betrayed God because of this guy.
Yeah. he gaslit her.
Yeah. But I just found it was so strange that it's a woman director who's not at all interested in the female perspective in this story.
I mean, you know, a lot of the great female directors have made films like that, you can say. You know, Mikey and Nikki, Beau Travai.
Yeah. Or Lena Wertmüller.
Yeah.
Not at all interested. Oh, and one other thing about Father Stu that was so funny is that there was a 5-minute scene of Father Stu checking into a motel and like phoning downstairs because the TV doesn't work. But then all these key moments in his life were not shown to us. Like we see him getting arrested for things, but we don't see what he did exactly.
Yes, it's very Maurice Pilat like elliptical storytelling.
I was kind of in heaven in that scene where he's talking to the woman at the front desk of the motel, and then he's checking out the room, and it had a real air of authenticity, like a Dardenne brothers, observational view of like desperate living of American people. But then all these things that you would think you would be shown in detail are just skipped.
Yeah.
I guess, again, the first time filmmaker curse. We should talk also about how this film shows this sort of long, mortifying decline in the Wahlberg character's health. I'm positive that Mark Wahlberg made this movie thinking that he was going to get an Oscar nomination for Best Actor.
Forget a nomination. I think he thought he was going to get a win.
He really does go through a big physical transformation that was partly prosthetics and partly weight gain. When Stu gets this muscle disorder that starts to weaken him, he starts to get really puffy and bloated to the point where I was actually trying not to laugh. Not because I thought that it was funny that this character is going through this decline, but more outside of myself, just knowing that Wahlberg's doing this to get an Oscar, you know, like he's trying to do a Raging Bull kind of thing. Well, I was just very aware of the craft.
Well, if you remember this, I believe like 2 or 3 years ago, Mark Wahlberg kind of broke the internet when on Instagram he posted his daily routine, which is basically he would get up at like 2:30 in the morning, do six workouts throughout the day, then do like 15-minute prayer session, 20 minutes of family time, like 6 business meetings. So you know that guy, is his diet and exercise is just rigorous, and he had to, you know... He had to, let's say, have a few Wahlburgers with the bun for a couple weeks to do this role. And you know that mentally must have just killed him.
And I do want to also single out the one scene where I try not to laugh, where they had the cliche scene where the religious man goes to church and asks God how he could be doing this to him, you know? And Wahlberg's really, really acting in that scene.
Yeah,
and
he's giving it his all.
He's giving it his all, but it is cringe. I wasn't moved by it. It seemed like capital A acting to me.
Yeah, well, that's the interesting thing about Wahlberg is that he does actually have a lot of range where he has the films like The Fighter or The Yards where he's extremely stoic, and I think he's great at that. But he also has the kind of bug-eyed side of him that I think you could see in like Pain and Gain or Ted or Mile 22 in particular. And he's definitely on the bug-eyed side here.
Yeah. To a certain extent, I was enjoying myself watching it. I mean, because the Father Stu character is such a clown and is so ridiculous and so wrong-headed. Like, he thinks that the way to succeed in Hollywood is to get a job working in the cold cut section of a supermarket.
Yeah, and just asking everyone if they know someone in Hollywood.
And he had that ridiculous mustache. But then when he goes off to the seminary, he cleans up his act and, you know, gets a proper haircut and shaves. And he didn't look like Father Stu anymore. He just turned into Mark Wahlberg to me.
Yeah.
One weird way that Mark's been promoting this movie to Catholic audiences is I saw this incredible photo outside a Catholic church where they have the bulletin boards in front of churches, and in the bulletin board display was a Father Stu poster and a personal letter from Marky Mark that says that it was an honor to portray the life story of this amazing priest, and that this movie, that he hoped to expand the man's message beyond those who knew him by making this film. And that to me seems like a coordinated effort from Sony Pictures to appeal to Catholic audiences, like to have a personal letter from Mark Wahlberg pinned up at churches.
Well, I mean, what was the last movie to really get, like, other than Passion of the Christ, to really get the evangelicals, you know, to pack them in? Because they tried with Noah, right? And that didn't really work.
No. There are some movies that are a little bit harder to swallow that get pushed to church groups, like Unplanned, the abortion film that was so graphic that the producers were shocked to get an R rating from the MPAA. But I don't think the producers of Father Stu were at all worried about getting an R rating. I feel like that's one of the changes that's happened with faith-based entertainment in the sort of the mega era, is that it's okay, you can get an R rating. And in fact, it's good if you get an R rating, and because we want to reach a wider audience. And if you're going to make a movie for a wider audience, it has to be in the language that people speak. And that includes F words. And, you know, the woke culture might not like it. You know, like that's the way they would push it to audiences, like, this is authentic.
Well, this has become a bit of a trend. This has happened a lot with the kind of return to movie going in the pandemic. And I remember this even happened a bit before. But with this, there's this trend of like filmed video, like video intros by the director of star of a new movie. It'd be like, you know, thanks for coming out to the theater. It really means a lot to us to keep original movie going alive in the time of the pandemic. Like M. Night Shyamalan did that for Old or whatever. I think they should have had Wahlberg do a filmed intro where he said, there's some curse words. Don't be afraid to cover your kids' ears if you want, you know?
Mm-hmm.
just to warn the more religious types. Okay.
Well, the religious types are now behind the eight ball. Like, they have to tolerate coarse language in this movie because now it's being thought of as that you're being woke if you're upset about these things.
Well, you know, I think even the woke cultural Marxist left, the dummycrats, so to speak, I think even they would be moved by the message of Father Stu. I think this is the film that can bring America together, honestly.
And one more thing that we should say about Mark Wahlberg. These movies are like supposed to be redemptive sagas. And, you know, he's made a few movies about somebody seeking redemption for their sins and all that jazz. But, you know, Mark Wahlberg's history, you watch a scene where all of a sudden he starts slamming this gay guy against the wall for coming on to him. And you think about some of the things that Mark Wahlberg has actually done that he's been convicted of. including like that felony assault that he did on this when he was a teenager. He and his pals attacked a Vietnamese American man, and I think the guy lost his eye or something in that fight. Wahlberg applied for a pardon from the state of Massachusetts, and the pardon was not granted. For what it's worth, Wahlberg has apologized to this man. Johnny Trinh was his name, and Trinh accepted the apology. But like, these are guys, Mel Gibson and Wahlberg, who are looking for redemption for their past sins, but then they do things that remind you of their past sins. There's also a scene where Mel Gibson says to Stu, when Stu tells him that he wants to become a priest, he says, well, that's like Hitler wanting to join the Anti-Defamation League. Like, why would, if Mel's girlfriend is making this movie, why would she want to include a scene that reminds everybody of her boyfriend's anti-Semitism?
That's a very good question. But, like, I think, like, all good, you know, like, all good artists, they're working through their personal issues through their art, you know? Like, they're not just disingenuously chasing trends. They're splaying their soul on a big 20-foot tall canvas that is the silver screen.
Yeah, I mean, like, Gibson is for what it's worth, he was sort of all right in this movie. I also liked him in Dragged Across Concrete. Like, Mel Gibson, a very deeply problematic man who is also an undeniable presence on screen. You know, how do you balance those two things? Like, it's not like you want to see more of Mel Gibson in a movie, but you're surprised that he's as good as he is, considering what a fucking mess he is.
Yeah, and I think maybe in a weird way, his troubled personal life has kind of bleeded into his art, or at least his acting, where he seems like he gives less of a fuck, or he's more based, or like he's been through some shit, and it kind of makes him a more soulful presence in a way.
But it leads me to wonder, you know, these are movies where they are trying to make these movies for a faith-based audience, but what they really are doing is rehabbing their own damaged reputations under the guise of making faith-based entertainment. One thing that I mentioned to you on our way out of the theater is that I tend to go to the Young and Dundas Cineplex to watch propaganda movies. I saw The Battle at Lake Changjin there, and then you and I went last night to watch Father Stu. But these films have more in common than they would normally admit. Like, they serve as propaganda, but they star movie stars, and they look like real movies.
Yeah, I mean, I remember there's a bit in The Hunt for Red October, the book, where it concludes with all the Soviets that have defected or have gathered around, and they're crying watching a VHS of E.T. Like, now they're ready to live in the capitalist West because of that movie. And yeah. I feel like you could do the reverse, where you could show members of the CCP Father Stu, and now they'd be ready to join the capitalist West.
You know, it's really too bad that Father Stu dies at the end, because this could have been the first movie in the Father Stu universe. They could have kept on making Father Stu movies. Because this movie was a different movie every 10 minutes. So if you made Father Stu part two, he could become a firefighter. He could become president of the United States. He could open a strip club. There's no limit to the imagination.
He could be a ghost in the second one. He could be like an Obi-Wan Force ghost consulting with people. Wait, would they call the sequel Father Stu?
Stu? Like
Stu?
Or Two Father, Two Stu?
Yeah.
Ethan, it was wonderful seeing this movie with you and taking one for the team. Like, there are a lot of people that I know who would never watch Father Stu, but I think that they need to know what this movie is.
Yeah, I mean, I was genuinely excited to see it, so it was my pleasure.
Yeah, a friend of mine said that this is sort of like, maybe this is a movie made for a very specific Boston sect of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I think New England. I was hoping New England and the Red States would come together to fuel this to a number one box office berth over Crimes of Dumbledore. But oh well.
Well, Ethan, thank you so much for joining me on this show. And where can people find you on Twitter?
I'm twitter.com/EthanVess. I review movies every once in a while for the film stage. Strangely enough, the only two movies I've reviewed so far this year are Rifkin's Festival and Morbius. But I didn't intend it to be that way. It just ended up that way. But keep an eye on that and read that website. But I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I haven't looked in a few years, but I'm there. I'm on Instagram, and I'm on the streets, heading out to see Father Stu. So.
Well, I want my listeners to know that before the movie, Ethan and I went over to the concession stand, and Ethan bought with his own money the limited edition Morbius metal cup for his Coke Zero. They were still selling Morbius cups.
And I've been drinking water out of it while recording this podcast.
Yeah, I wanted to take a picture of it, but I didn't. So I want the listeners to know that Morbius fever has not quite gone down in Toronto.
I'm still afflicted with it personally. I've got long Morbius.
Did you see Morbius?
I did at an advanced screening, so I didn't pay to see it.
Were you with the Morbius Discord community Toronto chapter?
I think they may. Some of them may have been there because when the movie ended, like everyone stayed in their seat to watch the end credits scene. So I think a lot of Morbius heads were in the theater.
Didn't the trailers for Morbius hint that there was going to be a Spider-Man appearance and then they didn't do it at all?
Yeah, I guess not. Maybe, I left before the end credits. Maybe it was there and I didn't see it, but...
Well, Ethan, thank you so much for joining me, and let's do it again sometime.
Yeah. Hopefully there's another Wahlberg movie soon.
Ethan Vespi, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Before we go, just a reminder that we do have a Patreon. Patrons get access to 2 additional bonus episodes every month. To become a patron, please go to patreon.com/junkfilter. And please follow us on Twitter at junkfilterpod. The original music for this program was provided by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken. Thank you for listening.